All right, everybody, welcome back. We're going to continue on in the Old Testament survey, Daniel 1, but I'm beginning at slide 86. Now I'm going to shift on into what I normally would have done when I'm actually preaching the book, because we had a kind of an overview of the theology and the background a bit before. So be confident, this idea of most of us actually struggling with confidence and being ourselves, it just really doesn't release that lion within you. You know, you can just assume that there's a lion within you. A lot of people are telling us that. A lot of people are telling us that you are God. You heard people tell you that? You are God. You just need to discover this in yourself, right? This is what people tell us today. I've had many people tell me, I'm God. I just have to release the Christ consciousness in me. And my response is normally, well, if I'm God, wouldn't I know that? If you're God, wouldn't you know it? Why would you have to keep discovering it, you know? People haven't really thought through these sort of things, but anyway. So we ask the question, what do you really need to know to be truly confident to understand what the message of Daniel is? The context, of course, is relating to Josiah's sons and the various prophets that God raised up that surrounded the fall of the city in 586 BC. The Lord had raised up Jeremiah some 40 years or so earlier, who preached for four decades telling the people, you better turn to the Lord and turn away from the idols to turn to the true and living God. Otherwise, the city's going to fall. Well, it doesn't actually fall in 605, but the Babylonians come in and they nab Daniel and three of his friends and some others. Handsome men, nobility, who were able to had a good aptitude for languages and all these sort of things that are mentioned in Daniel chapter 1. They get taken away, and the people still don't repent. So the Babylonians come in a second time some 7 years later or 8 years later. And Ezekiel gets taken on the second wave of the Babylonian invasions. Jerusalem hasn't fallen yet, but Daniel and Ezekiel are both taken away to Babylon in exile prior to the fall of the city. Why? God had things that he wanted to reveal to these men that would be applicable to the people that were already in exile. They needed hope. They needed encouragement. But he left Jeremiah there in Jerusalem to encourage the people there. God has his people at his place at his time. That includes you and me. It's important for us to fulfill the role that the Lord has us to play. Well, sadly, King Josiah is killed by the Egyptians when he's trying to interfere in the battle between the Egyptians and the Babylonians in 609. And his son, Jehoahaz, doesn't last very long, just 3 months. Things are very, very turbulent. Jehoiakim ends up becoming the king, but he doesn't really turn to the Lord. He does reign for 11 years. And during his reign, the Babylonians come for the first time in bring Daniel away. But after he's out of the way, exiled to Egypt, Jehoiachin then becomes the next king and doesn't last very long either. Look at that, 3 months. And once Jehoiachin is deposed, then finally we get the last king, Zedekiah. You know he has to be the last because his name is Zed, right? Okay, so. And lo and behold, he reigns for 11 years. Do you see the pattern here? 3 months, 11 years. 3 months, 11 years. So the two key kings of Jerusalem, of Judah, would be Jehoiakim and Zedekiah. Because the other guys really don't last very long. And they're just brief puppet kings. A puppet king means that the Babylonians are the ones holding all the strings. And it looks like the king is actually ruling, but not really the case. And when you got the ones who weren't puppet kings, Jehoiakim and Zedekiah, well, they're fighting against the king. So nobody's actually submitting to the Lord here. Nobody's submitting to God's judgment, God's discipline, and thus it leads to the fall of the city. So that's the background, understanding what happens, how Daniel is taken away. Feel free to ask any questions. I want to make sure we understand this. This will give us the background to Daniel and Ezekiel, as well as Jeremiah and Lamentations. This is the background to four of the five major prophets. All but which one? Isaiah. Isaiah is a whole century earlier. And by the way, these prophets, these five major prophets actually come in chronological order. Heading up the prophets is Isaiah, right? Then Jeremiah. So we see Jeremiah coming second here. If we think of Jeremiah continuing into Lamentations, then it would be chronological. Jeremiah and Lamentations together. And then Jeremiah and Daniel and Ezekiel. It depends on how you handle the Daniel and the Ezekiel one. Daniel actually starts earlier and ends later, so I guess you could... depends how you do your chronology there. In any case, the walkthrough people say dreams is their key word for the book of Daniel. I don't use that as the key word because I think it doesn't really give you the theology of the book. But yeah, definitely there are lots of dreams. Instead of counting sheep, he's counting, you know, lions that jump over the fence, right? So the Babylonians make their westward march. They conquer the Ninevites. They conquer the whole Assyrian kingdom, actually. And at the Battle of Carchemish, north of Syria, they have a climactic battle against the Egyptians. Once they defeat the Egyptians, they've defeated the other superpowers, Assyria and Babylonia. So they end up conquering Syria and Israel and Judah to the extent where they bring the people back in 605, starting with 605. There's actually going to be six deportations of the people under the Babylonian rule. And they bring them back to Babylon. Does that sound a little strange? You go conquer people and then you bring them back to your homeland? I mean, do you know of any other countries that do that? Did the Japanese do that? When they conquered Manchuria, did they go bring the people of Manchuria back to Japan? That's kind of contrary to the whole idea, right? They felt like they didn't have enough room in Japan. But that's not really parallel to what we have happening here. They brought back some of the nobility. They brought back some of the fluent, bright Hebrew speakers back to Babylon. They didn't bring thousands of people back. They wanted to make sure that these people who were young men of influence, we want to teach these guys to speak Babylonian. But it must be just absolutely devastating to be defeated in war. Some of us have seen that happen with our own countries. But was Babylon undefeatable? Not to God. And the people needed to know that. The Hanging Towers of Babylon. So God brought all of his messengers, Zephaniah and Jeremiah earlier on, Daniel and Ezekiel, who lived through the fall of Jerusalem, but from far away. Jeremiah from being right there. He also raised up Habakkuk. And I think Joel is written around this time as well. But it's difficult to date the book of Joel. And then Lamentations then appears after that, before the people are restored in 536. How interesting that the word Daniel literally means El, or God, is my judge. Here's a book about how God judges his people, and yet God is faithful to them. And so this is why I have the key word sovereignty to describe the book. And as we talked about before, the key verse talks about how God is all-powerful and he removes kings and establishes kings. Now, the issue of who wrote Daniel, sadly, ends up becoming a very big issue, more so than any book of the Old Testament. We see in the internal evidence that over and over, he's using the first person. I, Daniel, saw this and this happen, chapter 7 to 12, many other places there. And the external evidence outside the book shows, in Ezekiel 14, 14, God says, well, am I going to save that city? Even if Daniel were to argue to defend Jerusalem, I wouldn't listen, God says. Do you catch what that's saying? In Ezekiel's prophecy, he's saying, hey, Daniel, Daniel Thompson. He's saying, and that answer to your other question, Ezekiel's mentioned Daniel during the time of Ezekiel. Well, Ezekiel and Daniel lived at the same time. Wow. Do you catch it? So Ezekiel's acknowledging the existence of Daniel. That would be like, I acknowledge the existence of one of my colleagues, Dr. Andrew Spurgeon. And then this is found, centuries later. Oh, did he live during the time of Charles Spurgeon? No, not Charles Spurgeon. Rick Griffith lived during the time of Andrew Spurgeon. He mentioned it in class one day. He's my good friend. You see what it, that would be an evidence that Rick Griffith really did live in the 21st century. To those people who say, oh, no, he lived in the 25th century, four centuries later. So Jesus also quoted the book of Daniel, Matthew 24, 15. And so he's ascribing the authorship to Daniel as well. So Daniel is, he lived during this, around 605 to 536 is the last that we hear of anything relating to him. He would have been quite an old man by that time. So that's really important when it relates to the date of Daniel. I don't really spend much time talking about the dates of these various books, but it's very important when we come to the book of Daniel, because Daniel and Isaiah are the two books of the Old Testament where the dating is most challenged. Do you find it just a little circumstantial that Daniel and Isaiah happen to have the most specific prophecies of all the books of the Old Testament? And the fact that they have written during the time where it says they were writing is very, very important. And we're talking about the integrity of the book. We're talking about the integrity of God who knows the future. You see this in Isaiah 45, Isaiah 44. God says, who knows the future? Is it not I, the Lord? I know that Cyrus is going to come. He talks about Cyrus 140 years before Cyrus ever existed. I don't think it's just a circumstantial that these books are challenged in terms of their authority actually being written by these men. His prophecies go all the way to AD 70. But he has a lot of prophecies about Antiochus that are very specific, chapter 8 and chapter 11. And so some people say, well, he has to, that's a little pig there if you're wondering what that is. Antiochus sacrificed a pig on the altar in Jerusalem, and many, many people lost their lives. Daniel predicted it hundreds of years in advance. Now, the critics date the book of Daniel after 164, because they say, no way could Daniel have known this. And I agree with the critics. I agree. There was no way Daniel could have known this. But how about God telling Daniel? Could that have happened? I think so. I think God knows the future. And at times he reveals the future to his servants. And so the critics see the historical events recorded as quote-unquote prophecies. But as I was alluding to in the last class session, the Dead Sea Scrolls actually proves the conservative dating of the books, of Old Testament books. In the shrine of the book, which is shaped like the top of a shrine of a top of a jar that contains the scrolls. This is a circular museum in Jerusalem. For years, they had the Isaiah scroll there, and they have Daniel scroll there. It raises the question, when was the book of Daniel written? Well, conservatives like myself would say 560 BC, written during the time, maybe the end of Daniel's life, but liberals would put it in 164 BC. When you find a Daniel copy from the Dead Sea Scrolls, it makes it a little bit difficult. Very difficult, especially if a 200 BC date that I was alluding to this last time. Hopefully that makes a little more sense now. So what are some of the characteristics of the book of Daniel? Well, it's called the Apocalypse of the Old Testament because this book has more symbolic language than most other books. Zechariah will be pretty close to it as well, and we'll look at Zechariah in our last few sessions. God kept him in his profession as a politician. He was not like many of us are planning to be. We're planning to be full-time Christian workers. He was not a full-time Jewish worker. Or was he? He was he not? How do you define whether someone's in full-time ministry or not? It raises a lot of questions, I know. We normally define whether someone's in full-time ministry as, well, who pays his salary? Christians pay his salary. The church pays his salary. The mission organization pays her salary or whatever. You know what I mean? Oh, it must be full-time Christian work. I would say Daniel is more in the Lord's work than me, with a greater impact for the cause of God than I've ever had, even though I've been the so-called, you know, full-time Christian worker for the last 39 years. Daniel had, he's a lot more years than me anyway. And he did his ministry as a politician. God gave him opportunities that most of us in so-called full-time Christian work would love to have. I've never witnessed the gospel to a king before. Daniel did have that opportunity many times. The date's debated more than any other biblical book, as I noted. It's in two languages, as I noted. It's actually recorded outside of Israel, along with Ezekiel. Aren't those the only two books recorded outside of Israel? Think so. Not unless Jonah wrote his work, you know, while he was sitting east of the city of Nineveh. Daniel saw God's rule over the nations. This is the one that shows the times of the Gentiles better than any other book. Jesus used that phrase in Luke 21. They will fall by the edge of the sword and will be led captive into all nations. And Jerusalem will be trampled underfoot by the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. So here's Jesus, Luke 21, looking to the future. He's looking to Jerusalem being destroyed a second time, and Jerusalem trodden by the Gentiles until God's going to fulfill all his purposes for Jerusalem, and he's going to raise it up to be the city where his name is going to be proclaimed again. But in the midst of that, we have these 70-year exiles, and I say that in plural. I don't think I've covered this. Did I cover this one with you before? There's actually two 70-year exiles. The people were taken when Daniel was taken, at least the beginning of the people. There were some other exiles, other deportations following Daniel, one with 10,000, another with 10,000, etc. But there was just a few people that were brought with Daniel in 605. The people were really fully restored, you could say, 70 years later in 536. The temple also had an exile. It was destroyed in 586, and 70 years later, the temple was finished being rebuilt in 516. So in reality, you have two exiles that last 70 years. I say this because Jeremiah 25, verses 11 and 12, God specifically says through Jeremiah that Israel will be away for 70 years. Jeremiah 25, 11 to 12. But he doesn't say where it actually begins and ends. I'm just saying that there's a couple ways you could actually you can actually address this. So what we learn from the book is how to be truly confident in terms of these three truths. And as I noted before, the first truth is God rules over you. If you recognize that, as Daniel did in Daniel 1, then you could truly be confident. I sum up the chapter this way. The exiles could confidently trust God's sovereignty shown in rewarding Daniel's godliness into Babylon despite deportation. In other words, Daniel was the model exile. Daniel 1 is not just given to give us the context, which is certainly important. It's not just given to say, you know, make sure you eat the right food, because we don't really even have food laws that are applicable to us. The big picture in this book is that Daniel was able to recognize in his individual life what God was doing and how his individual life fits in the big picture. So that would be my question for you. Do you know how you fit into the big picture? Do you know how God's sovereignly working in your individual life so that you can fit in the big picture of what he's trying to do? Some of you say, yeah, I see so much heartache going on right now, and God's giving me the skills I need to be a counselor so I can fit in to make sure that people are spiritually and emotionally able to handle the issues in their lives so they can be leaders in the churches, so they can reach people for Jesus. So missionaries don't have to come back broken from their first term overseas. God's working in your heart for many of you that are trained to be counselors, and he's going to refine it as it goes along. And it'll be fun to talk to you in the coming years. Some of our students, one of ours went to Mongolia and started a counseling ministry there. Another one went to India, started a counseling ministry there. You know, and it's exciting. And some of my music students gone to Indonesia, started music school. Just exciting because they say, this is how God is working, sovereignly working in my life. I need to be the model musician to give true praise to God and not be caught up in just performance. And all the Christians in my country or whatever are involved in performance or whatever it might be. The Lord is going to refine in your own thinking how he wants you to fit into his plan. It's an exciting thing to see how it all works. So the universal sovereignty in the times of the Gentiles does not exclude God's sovereignty over the individual, i.e. you, specifically as we see here in Daniel's life. It doesn't come easy, because these guys were very handsome men and they were getting their MDiv degree at the University of Babylon. But their curriculum was slightly different than our MDiv. It was a 3-year program. We find in Daniel 1 that they were brought over to Babylon for 3 years. Young man without physical defect and all that. He was to teach them the language and literature of the Babylonians. And they were to be trained for 3 years, Daniel 1:5. Doesn't 3 years learning about the Babylonian divinities sound like a master of divinity to you? Actually, this is not a master of divinity. It's a master of divinities, plural. So, part of their MDiv studies is their names have to get changed. Daniel, God is my judge. He gets named after the pagan god Bel. Belteshazzar. Bel, protect his life. The only one I think who actually uses this name is the king. He keeps getting referred to as Daniel, you know. Hananiah, he does take on the name of the moon god, Aku. The Lord is gracious. You know, let's not talk about God's graciousness in your name. Let's talk about the command of Aku, the moon god. Mishael, who is what God is, was changed to Mishach, who is what Aku is. You know? And then Azariah means the Lord helps, and that was changed to Abednego, or whom the Lord helps, servant of Nego, or servant of Nebo. Whose servant is he, really? See how all these names are paganized? We kind of try to do the same, the opposite way, don't we? When people come out of paganism and embrace Jesus, their names are changed to Peter, Daniel, Ruth, Esther, Grace, etc., right? We try to do the opposite to, I don't know if you're named after a pagan, any of you named after pagan deities? My name, Richard, literally means strong ruler. Really, you know? Why would I want to be named after strong ruler? The ruler, I mean, God's the strong ruler, it's not me. I'm not a ruler anyway, you know? Anyway, maybe you have a hard time remembering their names. Just think of Shad Shack, My Shack, and a bungalow. And that'll help you, because these are hard names. But anyway, what they say is, they say no to defiled food. This is not a small matter for teenagers, is it? These are teenagers. The king's choice food is put before them. I'll show you pictures like this. Don't worry, it's only 22 minutes till lunch. You know, add some Brussels sprouts to it. That's a de-appetizer for many of us, you know. But so that's the king's choice food, and here's Daniel's food of choice. You know?
You are very cruel.
Very. These vegetables, that's to whet your appetite for lunch. So some people have, you can go on the internet and get Daniel's diet, the 10-day detox and weight loss plan. Surely somebody's going to get $28 out of you, right? By talking about Daniel's diet, as if that's the issue here. The issue is their obedience to God, you know? And actually, at the end of it, nobody compared to these four men. No one. The king evaluated them, and Nebuchadnezzar looked at him. He says, wow, in every matter of wisdom and understanding about which the king questioned them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and enchanters in his whole kingdom. And look at the last statement of Daniel 1. And Daniel remained there until the first year of King Cyrus. We're all supposed to go, wow, the first year of King Cyrus. Daniel was there to the first year of King Cyrus? No, you don't read it like that, right? You kind of go, huh? Who's Cyrus? What was the first year? What? Huh? What? You have to know your chronology here. When you realize that's like 67 years later, something, what was it? It's a long time. That basically is like saying, he started, he was an assistant for Lee Kuang Yew, and then he ended up being an assistant to the grandson of Lee Kuang Yew, who was the prime minister of Singapore. I don't think that's going to happen, but anyway, that'd be like looking to the future. And you would say, what? You mean 1959? He started in government in 1959, and we just had a senator die last year at age 94 in the U.S. who served over 60 years in the Senate. Can you imagine? That would be like, yeah, he was there kind of in the World War II, you know. Anyway, the point being, the kings, the ones we think are the great authorities, they come and go, and they come and go, and they come and go. But Daniel, meek, lowly Daniel, God exalts him because he exalts God. And he lasts decades through many administrations. And even the destruction of Babylon, he's still there. Here's my question. Are our teenagers today doing better or worse than Daniel at holding to godly convictions? Well, your answer to that question will reflect your experience. I hope you would say they're doing far better. They're just, our teenagers are just so well grounded now. Even if Singapore was destroyed, these Christian teenagers we've got here, if they were brought to a pagan land, they would still hold true to the Lord. I hope you could say that's, well, what you say, it doesn't matter, but reality is what matters. I know in my own country, the Lord is raising up a new generation, but for the most part, most teenagers are flaking out spiritually when they get in their 20s. And I mean 80% to 90%. So how do you apply Daniel 1? Be confident in your pagan setting that God can help you not violate your godly convictions. In other words, you can also be a model exile. Many of us here, after we get out of the college, we're going to go work for secular organizations, right? You're going to be a... But are you going to be a secular counselor? No, be a Christian counselor in a secular organization. Be a Christian musician in the university God puts you as a professor. Or wherever it is. Whoever pays your salary in the years to come, still be God's full-time Christian worker. Like Daniel was. Except he was God's full-time Jewish worker. You know? All right, so much more to say on that. But I'm gonna need to skip a few hundred slides here. So God rules over you. God rules over all nations as we get to Daniel 2, slide 155. And here's the point of this next section, I believe. The exiles could confidently trust God's sovereignty over the nations, seen in Daniel's devotion and prophecy of the times of the Gentiles. In other words, Daniel saw world history in advance. He didn't write world history of what had already happened. God gave him a vision of what was going to happen nation after nation after nation. It's pretty amazing. And it starts off with statues, where he ends up being the interpreter. The king has this image, a vision of an image, and wow, he has no idea what in the world this is talking about. But Daniel is brought before him and actually saves the lives of his fellow administrators, because he gets from God a vision of the vision. He knows what the king's thinking, even the king doesn't tell him what the vision is all about. You know? And the dream, of course, is about this material statue that has the head of gold, that has the arms and the belly of the silver, and then the bronze, torso, legs of clay and what was it?
Iron.
Legs of iron, actually. Clay and iron mixed in the feet. And then this huge stone, hewn out of the mountain, goes and crashes the image. And guess what? It's not just the last kingdom falls, but the whole statue falls. In other words, all those kingdoms are destroyed at once. We often think it's only that last kingdom that's actually destroyed. You can go to Free Bible Images. You can see these things that these people put together. And so Daniel gives the interpretation. All right? From gold to silver to bronze to iron and clay. And then the stone that comes and knocks them all down. And he says, Nebuchadnezzar, you, or the Babylonians, are the head of that head of gold. The Persians, along with the Medes, are the... Maybe one arm is Persian, the other arm is Medes, I don't know. And then the Greeks follow, and then the Romans are actually going to follow the Greeks. Who could have known that those four kingdoms would follow in exactly the succession that God said? And we're even looking at... I would guess that we're living in the age of Rome, you might say. But there's going to be a ruler yet to come called the Antichrist. And the Messiah is going to come and actually destroy not just that kingdom, but it's going to destroy all those kingdoms. And so Christ's kingdom, when Christ's kingdom comes, it's going to destroy all of the kingdoms that will fall at the same time. And Jesus' rule will be over this whole world. So that is one of the key ideas there. Now, we get a statue in chapter 2, but the statue ends up becoming an idol in chapter 3. We had many different materials in that statue of chapter 2. Nebuchadnezzar goes, so I'm the head of gold, huh? How about if I make a big, big idol, all of gold? 90 feet tall, 9 feet wide.
Bad idea, king. Bad idea.
No, you keep, realize your place. You're just the head of gold. The whole thing's not supposed to be gold, and they're not supposed to be worshiping you. He didn't quite get the picture. So Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah refused to bow before this. Did I have the wrong one there? Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. Oh. Yeah, anyway. Yeah, these are the guys. And I think my slides are a little bit out of it. Anyway, they weren't three stooges. They were three soldiers, you might say, for the Lord. They refuse. This is not exactly religious tolerance. And they're standing alone. They do it with the right attitude, though. And actually, God had said, the Lord will exile you and your king to an unknown, and to a nation unknown to you and your ancestors, and there you, in exile, you'll worship gods of wood and stone, Deuteronomy 28. But not all of them. And these three guys are willing to be thrown into the fiery furnace. But you know the story. One of them looks like the son of the gods among the four, not the three. And God rescues them. They are, again, model exiles. To the point of death, we need to truly be following the Lord. Nebuchadnezzar still doesn't get it. So God gives them this image of this huge tree that gets cut down. And he specifically is told by Daniel, that's you. That tree depicts you. Don't exalt yourself. God made you the big tree, and you've got shade for the whole world and all that. But don't let it go to your head. He didn't heed it. He forgot. And a year later, as Nebuchadnezzar looked across the city, he said, look at this great city of Babylon. By my own mighty power, I've built this beautiful city as my royal residence to display my majestic splendor. Notice how many my's and I's are there. Is this even true? Was Nebuchadnezzar the first king of Babylon? Hardly. Nebuchadnezzar didn't live until 600s BC. Babylon was built by Nimrod way back in Genesis 10. And even the old Babylonian Empire under Hammurabi, it was like 1,200 years before Nebuchadnezzar. But you know, you do a few improvements, like, yeah, I sure built the city, didn't I, you know? I mean, who could take credit, for example, of building Singapore? There's no one person that could take credit for that. This has been a combined, or take any city of the world. You build upon those who are before you. But anyway, we're not really very objective when we start exalting ourselves, are we? So God gives them involuntary vegetarianism. Go for 7 years to live like an animal, where your fingernails don't get... Ooh, looks like my fingernails need a little bit, getting a little clipped here. You know, if my fingernails get... I remember when our sons, when their nails got too long, my wife would go, hey, you guys, you got Nebuchadnezzar nails. Just go ahead and... Here's a little clipper for you so you don't you deal with your Nebuchadnezzar nails. That's one way to how to teach the Bible, just through the regular things of life, right? And so William Blake depicts it with his long hair. Here's the point. Exalt yourself, you get deposed, you know? And this is really a chiasm here in chapters 2 to 7. So we have the kingdom image of history destroyed, chapter 2. It actually comes with kingdom images of history destroyed, but in the form of beasts in chapter 7. We have deliverance in chapters 3 and 6 from a fiery furnace and deliverance from lion's den. And in the center of the chiasm, we've got Nebuchadnezzar humbled and Belshazzar humbled. They're the focal point of this literary structure. Here's the point. No matter whether you are king of the whole world, you're still below God. You're still at his service, you know? So Nebuchadnezzar gets humbled, like after the tree there. Belshazzar gets humbled. That's the one we've got on our note in our notes here, you know, your front page of your notes. So this is the Belshazzar getting humbled in Daniel 5. He had plenty of cups to drink from, but he wanted to drink from the cups of the God who they destroyed, his father destroyed in Jerusalem. Those goblets. And God says, meanie, meanie. God was a meanie to him, you know. It's a pretty good picture by Rembrandt, except if you know Hebrew, you realize he's got the Hebrew wrong. He's got Hebrew going vertically here instead of horizontally, but anyway. Maybe Rembrandt had a Chinese consultant or something like that. Who was, you know, the Chinese read saying yes all the time, right? Because they're putting their heads up and down like this. Whereas for my culture, we always say no when we read. We're reading back and forth like that. And so what happens? The city falls. He exalts himself. And so the Persians enter under the water gates. They cut off the water going through the city of Babylon. Water diverts around the city. Water goes down. Guys go under the gate. They go conquer their way over to the city gate, open it up. The main Persian army comes in. In one night, Babylon fell. It took 13 years to conquer Tyre. A 13-year siege. It didn't even take 13 hours to conquer Babylon. That had exalted itself before the Lord. God has the last word. Okay. Skip, 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 skip. A few hundred slides. Then we get to the four beasts of Daniel 7. These four beasts end up depicting what we saw in the multi-material statue. Babylon depicted as a winged lion. The bear with one side up more than the other is the Medes and the Persians. The leopards are depicting a leopard with multi-head depicts the Greeks or Alexander in particular. And then the terrifying beasts with 10 heads and one of them, one of the little horns, 10 horns as well, depicting the Antichrist yet to come. So we see, as you have on 545, this statue ends up depicting the same thing as the vision of the four beasts. And then chapter 8 zeroes in on the ram and the goat, the second and the third kingdom. So all of these kingdoms go in the exact order in which God says that they were going to go. So how do you apply Daniel 2? Be confident that God still rules over the nations today. That's how I do it, you know. That's such an encouragement to me. So to be truly confident, realize his rule over you as an individual, over all nations, and then as we saw The last section of the book talks about God's rule over Israel's future. Now, here's the point, I think, of the last section of the book. The exiles could confidently trust God's sovereignty over Israel in the times of the Gentiles by being faithful to his covenant. So not only did Daniel see world history in advance, but he saw Jewish history in advance. And this is depicted as we get into the book of Daniel chapter 8. Could he really know what was going to happen 300 years in advance? Well, he's God. Let's not think he's so limited, you know? So we see in chapter 8, the powerful ram with two horns comes, and a goat defeats the ram, Alexander. Here's a dip. Daniel 8, verses 5 to 7 is a prophecy of Alexander the Great 300 years before Alexander ever lived. You can see why the critics don't want to think that this is actually said in advance. And then Antiochus Epiphanes, one of the generals who followed Alexander, his whole career is depicted there. And even the Maccabean and the Hanukkah feast that comes out of that, 167 to 164, comes out of all this. All this is in chapter 8. It's quite an incredible thing. And it goes against what you normally would think. You know, which is stronger and faster, goat or ram? You know, what would you say would move faster? I got the wrong ram there. There's a right ram there. Yeah. A ram is called a ram for a reason. A ram rams. Rams are good at ramming. That's why they're called rams. But here's a goat who never touches the ground. Whee! Smaller, and the goat actually beats the ram. You don't see that happen. And that's Alexander, the fast, small goat, with a very small army, 30,000 or less, defeats the Persian army of, what, 200,000? I mean, it's like huge. He defeats them. He just goes right on in to kill the right at the heart of them. And so we see the ram and the goat. And the goat actually wins. But the goat has four horns. And the four horns are the four generals of Alexander's that after Alexander dies there in Babylon, of all places, he dies. Ooh, gives up the ghost. His downfall is due to desire for worship, and then wine, women, song. Okay? Alexander could conquer the world, but he couldn't conquer his own passions. And the Greek Empire then is part given to Seleucus, part to Ptolemy, part to Lysimachus, and part to Cassander. Exactly what Daniel 8 says was going to happen. The whole thing was going to be divided up. Well, what was God going to do with his people? Daniel 9, he prays, Lord, well, what about us? We're going to be going back to the land, right? After this 70 years exile, God says, let me tell you what's going to happen. A period of 70 sets of seven has been decreed for you and your people to do six things. Finish rebellion, end sin, atone for guilt, bring in everlasting righteousness, confirm the prophetic vision, and anoint the most holy place. Daniel 9:24 is very key. Here's the point. These were not fulfilled in the first century. That still hasn't been fulfilled. I think what we've got here in the first three is there's a tribulation yet to come, and then there's a millennium to follow that, where these are going to actually take place for all of this to happen. And specifically, he says, from the issuing of the decree to restore and rebuild Jerusalem until the anointed one comes, there will be seven sevens and 62 sevens. He's actually not talking about weeks here. This didn't happen in a year and a half period. He's saying these 69 sevens, and almost everybody would agree that we're talking about years here. He's talking about 483 years. And then there's going to be a one period of seven after that, a seven-year period after that. Well, if you do the math, and we don't have the time to get into it, it actually ends up to the 30th March AD 33. Literally, Daniel actually predicted 173,833 days, right? Years in advance. Just absolutely astonishing. We're talking about him predicting the actual day and year of Jesus' appearance in Jerusalem. No wonder why Jesus said in Luke 19, when he approached Jerusalem and he wept over it, he said, "Oh, if only you had known this day the things which make for peace, but they've been hidden from your eyes." Wow, I think Jesus knew this is the day that Daniel was actually predicting, that hundreds and hundreds of years previous to that. And this 70th week then follows Daniel 9:27. He'll confirm a covenant with many for 1 7. In other words, 1 7-year period. But in the middle of it, he'll put an end to sacrifice and offering. He'll break his covenant. And on the wing of the temple, he'll set up an abomination that causes desolation until the end that's decreed is poured out on him. I think we've got a 7-year period yet to come that will initiate at the midpoint when this one who's like the ruler Titus to come, he's going to exalt himself, just like we see these other kings doing in the book of Daniel. And yet God's going to use it to bring about the second coming of Jesus. And here's where the book of Revelation fits in, where you've got 7 seals, you've got these trumpet blasts and bowls poured out. It actually fits quite clearly with what we've got in the book of Revelation, where there's a 7-year treaty made with Israel. You know what that means? That means we're going to need another temple in Jerusalem. I don't know if it's going to happen right next to the Dome of the Rock, like some people would think it might happen. I don't have a strong opinion on that, but I think it is going to happen, because it has to happen for Daniel 9:27 to come about. How can you declare yourself to be God in the temple if there's no temple? There has to be a rebuilt temple. I know we're out of time, but Daniel 11 has over 100 prophecies about these various kingdoms. Absolutely incredible and good, worthy of our study. I would really encourage you to study them. And then when we finally get to the last chapter of Daniel, we see a depiction of the future for Israel. That Daniel depicts when Michael will arise, and you've got people being resurrected. But you, Daniel, keep this prophecy a secret. Seal it up until the time of the end, when many will rush here and there and knowledge will increase. I don't even think we've begun to see people rushing here and there with car planes being built now. I hear that there's that people are looking at prototypes of that in Singapore, where you could fly around Singapore. I just heard about that a couple days ago, where you can be in a little vehicle, unmanned, and it'll bring you from one place to Singapore to the next. Wow. But those who are wise will shine as bright as the sky, and those who lead many to righteousness will shine like the stars. And so the last chapter is really a message of hope. And I hope it's a message for you to be confident that God still rules over Israel today. He knows what it's doing. He controls each level, individual, national, international. And Daniel tells us to put this kind of faith in our sovereign God. And I'm glad to see you realize that in your own life, and trust and encourage you to continue doing that and trusting the Lord.